The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
When they published All the President's Men in 1974, their remarkable reporting won a Pulitzer Prize for the Washington Post and toppled then-President Richard Nixon. A week after Nixon's resignation, a staff member of the House Judiciary Committee's impeachment inquiry packed up a Volkswagen and left Washington, D.C. to join her boyfriend in Arkansas to help in his campaign for election to the U.S. Congress. The rest, as they say, is her story. Here to tell us the story of a woman in charge, the life of Hillary Rodham Clinton, is Carl Bernstein.
Hello. Well, it's great to be in Philadelphia. That was a lovely introduction on debate day. Well, why don't I ask you all some questions? How many of you all have decided whom you're going to vote for in the primaries? And of those who have decided, how many are supporting Hillary Clinton? And how many are supporting a Republican? No surprises there. And how many of you are supporting Obama? Edwards. Starbucks. Thank you. Okay. Maybe I should begin. I'm going to make this really informal and a conversation between us. And also talk about journalism a little bit, too, I think. Because, you know, really, good biography and good journalism are the same thing, the best obtainable version of the truth. And I would suggest that had we had really good biography about George Bush in the year 2000, he probably would not be president. And I think there's a pretty good biography of Obama out there. I've read parts of it. This book, Hillary Clinton, A Woman in Charge, is somewhat different in that it's the result of 7 years' work and interviews with some 200 people who have known Hillary Clinton probably best through her life, who have been with her at the major junctures of her life. Most of the interviews are on the record. Most of the people were interviewed several times. And I think that one of the reasons the reviews have been so gratifying is because what emerges is the best obtainable version of the truth. And that it turns out that the life of Hillary Clinton until now, to a large extent, has been dominated in terms of the way she is perceived by caricature. And happily, I think I was able to get way beyond caricature. And that the reason that it's been dominated by caricature is that until now, most of what we have known about Hillary Clinton has been misinformation and disinformation promulgated on the one hand by her opponents and her enemies, and on the other hand by acolytes and true believers. I started to giggle there when I said acolytes. The other day I used that word and talking to a group of people, and there was somebody there from one of the cable networks and wrote the story, and it came out acolytes, acolytes. Go figure. But so much of what we know, here is the most famous woman in the world, unquestionably, and as she has said, I'm a mystery. Now, she's a mystery partly because she would like to be a mystery, that she has contributed to the caricature by, in her own attempts at memoir or autobiography in living history and in It Takes a Village. These are largely political works with political objectives, written at crucial moments in her political career, once in the White House and once in the Senate. And there is also a baseline truthfulness to those abbreviated accounts of parts of her life, but there are huge omissions and elisions and obfuscations, beginning, obviously, as I found out, and I guess which was one of the headlines generated by my book, that Bill Clinton had wanted to leave the marriage in 1989, that he thought he had fallen in love with another woman, and that Hillary Clinton would not give him a pass out of the marriage, as the phrase was put by Betsy Wright, Bill Clinton's chief of staff in Arkansas, who I spent dozens and dozens of hours talking with and who was the keeper of the Clinton secrets to a large extent, both in Arkansas and in the presidential campaign. But what I was interested in doing is, you know, why did I decide to write a book about Hillary Clinton? Well, after the impeachment of Bill Clinton and the Lewinsky ugliness, I was fascinated by the idea that everybody involved was diminished horribly except Hillary Clinton. And her stature was enhanced. And at a time when in the first 5 or 6 years of the Clinton presidency, she had become damaged goods, even inside the White House, to the extent that when Bill Clinton ran for re-election in 1996, Hillary Clinton could only campaign for Bill Clinton before captive audiences of Democratic constituencies that were already firmly behind him. The election of the Newt Gingrich Congress, this tectonic shift in our politics that took place in 1994, was largely a response to Hillary Clinton's failures in health care and her involvement in this constellation of events that came to be regarded perhaps unfairly as an ethical pall that hung over the Clinton White House. Whitewater, Travelgate, all these other appellations that had been applied to the difficulties in the first years of the Clinton presidency. But that election, which was, you know, ended the Democratic dominance of the Congress of the United States that went back to the time of Roosevelt, that was largely a reaction to Hillary Clinton, not just Bill Clinton. And so I was fascinated that after the impeachment, here the President of the United States was horribly diminished. The Supreme Court of the United States, which had let the Paula Jones case go forward, an outrageous decision that a sitting President of the United States could be subjected to a civil lawsuit as it went through the courts and take his depositions while he was the President of the United States. The judiciary was diminished. The press was diminished, which had rightfully covered the Lewinsky story as a huge story, but had also failed largely to report on the story of an out-of-control independent prosecutor who was ideologically motivated. And, of course, diminished terribly was the Republican Congress of the United States that had initiated the impeachment. And many of those who had initiated the impeachment, of course, are no longer members of Congress because of their own sexual hypocrisy. And yet Hillary Clinton really came into her own. She saved Bill Clinton's presidency. She went out and campaigned for Democratic senators in 1998 before the impeachment proceedings. All of those she campaigned for, running for Congress, won. And she was integral to the basic strategy of fighting impeachment. And as she had in the Lewinsky denouement itself, she saved the presidency, first the Clinton presidency, first when she appeared on the Today Show and said that she believed her husband, which she did. Second, when she stayed in the marriage after his acknowledgement to the country and to her that he had lied. And then I also knew that while the Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice Rehnquist, was presiding over Bill Clinton's trial, wearing his robes he had designed himself with those gold flourishes on his sleeve, taken appropriately from a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. I knew that while the roll was being called on the two charges of high crimes and misdemeanors against Clinton in that Senate chamber, Hillary was meeting in the White House with Harold Ickes, her so-called Svengali, a little overstated, but a popular term at the time, deciding whether or not she wanted to run to join that same Senate that was judging her husband, looking at maps of the state of New York where she had never lived. And so I knew this meeting was going on, and I said to myself, this is a hell of a story. This is a better story than anybody knows. The real story here is Hillary Clinton now. So I decided I would do a biography of Hillary Clinton. And the first person I went to said to me, well, Carl, if you're going to do this book, and this was somebody who one of the principals in both of the Clinton campaigns, said, if you're going to do this book on Hillary, and probably someone closer to Hillary than to Bill, you have to really start with her Methodism. So I said, what? I mean, I knew she was Methodist, but it turns out that really the foundations of Hillary Clinton's life, from childhood to the present, are religion and family. And that unless you understand that and unless you see how religion and family inform her political beliefs, her value system, unless you see this thread that goes all through her life and keeps things together, you cannot begin to understand the life of Hillary Clinton. So that started out as being the first of one surprise after another as I went on this journey of reporting this remarkable life that is nothing like the caricature. Because, you know, Joan Didion has written about how writers write to really figure out what they believe. And I think that that's true. And that reporters, and as we write, and start to put the pieces together based on our reporting. After it's all down there on the page, then things start to shimmer a little bit and we start to see patterns that we didn't know were there when we wrote one episode or another, and we start to see themes and things start to come together in a way that makes sense that they never did before. And I remember during Watergate when we wrote what was the really the story that changed everything, and I did the actual draft of that particular story. And I remember writing that the Watergate break-in was part of a vast campaign of political espionage and sabotage conducted by the Nixon apparatus against its political enemies, something to that effect. But very carefully choosing those words. And finally, Watergate made sense. It wasn't an isolated break-in. It was part of this vast campaign of political espionage and sabotage. And it started to explain so much. And this was a huge story. It ran page and a half in the paper. And the same feeling I got from that story, I started to get as this story of Hillary Clinton was pieced together. Oh, now we finally get an idea who the real person is. And at every turn, she is infinitely more complicated, often ambiguous circumstances, and it's the context of this big life and the patterns and the themes that become so important. And one of the themes that I started to recognize, though I never labeled it as such in the book, but you will see when you read this book, and incidentally, I want everybody here to read this book. Buy the book. You don't like the book, go to my website, send me an email, I send you the money back. That's the deal. Because I am messianic about this. I think people need to know about whoever may be our next president, whether it's Obama or whether it's Hillary. And I know here is a chance. Also, it's fun to read. Wait till you see. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton never went to a shrink together in Arkansas. But Bill Clinton and Betsy Wright, his chief of staff, did go to a shrink together, who declared them codependent. There's really some funny stuff in the book. But you know, the other initial huge surprise was her early life, which she has always described and others in the caricatures have described as kind of this mid-century suburban idol in outside of Chicago. Well, it was nothing but. That in fact, there are hellish elements of her childhood, as well as a measure of some security. But her father, it turns out, was a misanthrope, a martinet, who verbally abused and humiliated, and demeaned and diminished her mother. I spent many, many hours with Betsy Johnson Ebeling, who was Hillary's closest childhood friend in Park Ridge, Illinois, and has remained a very close friend, stayed at the White House many times during the Clinton presidency, including during the Lewinsky ugliness. And Betsy Ebeling was the first who told me about how her father would, at the dinner table, he'd throw out a topic of conversation, almost like a glove on a table, provocatively. Hillary and her brothers and her father would begin discussing the topic, and her mother, who had been abandoned as a child at age 8 by her own parents, who were teenagers when she was born, her mother would try to join the discussion, and very often her father would say to her mother, what do you know? How do you know anything, Miss Smarty Pants? Where do you think you got the education to know this stuff? And Hillary's mother would become very hurt, and sometimes she would get up and leave and say, I can't take this anymore. I'm out of here. And Hugh Rodham, Hillary's father, would say, well, don't let the screen door hit you in the ass on the way out. Well, Hillary became reluctant to bring friends home from school. And so you see at the beginning of her as a child, this fear of humiliation, fear of embarrassments, the humiliation of her mother, the diminution of her mother. And you don't have to be the Soprano family shrink to do a lot of calculations here and figure, well, maybe this might affect, like all of us, who were affected by childhood experience or later life. And her mother counseled Hillary and her brothers, people don't get divorced in this family. Children are like, if divorce are like little boats that get swamped. So right away you start to say, oh, that's interesting. And there's also, I think, a rosebud moment in Hillary Clinton's life, which, interestingly enough, she provides it to us in the truncated version of her life in Living History, her memoir, in which she says, in a throwaway sentence, that she failed the District of Columbia bar exam. I read that sentence and I said, this is incredible. So I went first to Webb Hubble, who was very helpful on the book, who had been her law partner and had gone to jail in the Clinton presidency. He was associate attorney general. I said, Webb, did you know that Hillary failed a bar exam? He said, no, it couldn't have happened. I'm her law partner. Of course, if she didn't fail the bar exam. I said, no, she failed the bar. I went and looked at the records. And about 700 people had taken the D.C. bar that day. And here was Hillary, fresh out of Yale Law School. About 100 of the 700 had not passed, including Hillary. She was, I believe, the only Yale Law graduate not to pass. And, of course, many people failed the bar the first time, including great judges and lawyers. But she never took it again. And thereafter, she then went to work for the House Impeachment Committee, as the introduction today indicated. And she took at Bill's behest, she took the Arkansas bar and passed. She never went back and took the D.C. bar exam. And as you heard earlier, 2 days after that investigation was over, Richard Nixon, she went to Arkansas, followed Bill Clinton to Arkansas, and the rest is history. And yet, she never told anybody. I went to Nancy Bekovac, who was Bill and Hillary's closest friend in law school, also talks to them every few weeks, all their friends. None knew Hillary, her closest friends, Betsy Ebeling, none of them knew she had failed the bar exam. She kept it secret for 30 years. Fear of embarrassment, shame. And think of this pivotal moment in her life. She was telling people how she could work at any Washington law firm and had offers from fancy Washington law firms, which I think she did. But she couldn't go on to work there as a lawyer unless she took it again, and she didn't. So here you have certainly the biggest failure of her life until the failure of health care. I think it's a monumental event if it was sufficient for her never to tell her closest friends for some 30 years. Secrets. There are a lot of secrets. And, of course, what happened when I wrote this book is, and it was publicized, is a lot of the secrets came out. And the secrets were not about terrible illegalities such as were alleged by opponents and enemies in Whitewater. You know, Whitewater was about embarrassments. What did Whitewater really show after all that investigating by the out-of-control special prosecutor? That she had a conflict of interest of the kind that lawyers have all the time in state capitals, and that she represented some clients who had business with the state government that her husband had been the attorney general and governor of, and not very huge conflicts at that, including in Whitewater. Her own investment. Fear of embarrassment. What do the billing records show that moved around as if by poltergeist? They show that her law practice was not commensurate with someone reputed to be one of the top 100 lawyers in America. It was nickel-dime stuff. And a lot of it was handed off to an associate. The really magnificent work that Hillary Clinton did in that period was pro bono. And the work that she did as the chairman of the Neighborhood Legal Services Board that Jimmy Carter had appointed her to and that the Republicans had tried to decimate, she saved legal services for the poor in this country. Single-handedly. And it is probably her greatest achievement. So they're all, nothing is ever quite like the caricature. And the real life is absolutely compelling. For instance, Hillary Clinton had far more real experience, romantic experience, with men than Bill Clinton had real romantic, meaningful experience with women. by the time they met. She had a boyfriend at Wellesley who went to Harvard, and he gave me a couple of letters she had sent him. Well, they're amazing. One of them is about a field of daffodils they had visited, and she describes it as a great cathedral, these daffodils blowing in the wind. You know, it's the letter of a young woman in love. But it all turns, you also see in the Wellesley years a young woman becoming in charge of her own life as she never had been when she was trying to please her father without success because he was incapable of expressing real affection, though he taught her to hit a softball and taught her to play pinochle and read the stock tables. But never could express affection. And he was an odd duck. I mean, his sons, one was a quarterback and he had played football in college. And when his son would be playing, you Rodham, Hillary's father, would go to the game, and instead of sitting with all the other fans and family in the stands, he'd take a deck chair and sit down on the sidelines by himself. And when he threw 9 of 10 passes for touchdowns, he asked his son, what happened to the other pass? The same way he asked Hillary when she got all A's and a B, why'd you get a B? And usually the kids could tell when he was being cantankerous, but then sometimes they couldn't by their own accounts. And he also had depression in his family. And the theme of depression also permeates the book. Hillary had a really bad depression in her first semester at Wellesley. And she had come under the influence of a youth minister in Park Ridge who had come in her junior year in high school to Park Ridge with not just the Gospels of Christ but the Gospels of Bob Dylan in the form of Dylan records and copies of Picasso's masterpieces, including Guernica, the great tableau of the agony of the Spanish Civil War. He took Hillary and the other kids from Park Ridge to hear Martin Luther King preach downtown in Chicago. Bill Clinton, of course, who regards Jefferson, King, and Kennedy as his three great heroes, never met Martin Luther King. Hillary did. And it changed her life. She babysat for migrant children. Hillary is someone, unlike Bill, who's a classic intellectual, who operates off received wisdom of others and his own reading. Hillary does things. You know, she was somebody who played Martha in a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in college. She worked up in Alaska spooning the guts out of wild king salmon to be put in tins. Told the head of the cannery that he was putting some spoiled fish in and got fired. She also was always often fascinated by radicalism, yet always moved away from it ultimately. She wrote her senior thesis at Wellesley on Saul Alinsky, the great Chicago radical organizer, and then classic Hillary had the thesis locked up when Bill Clinton won the presidency so nobody could look at it. But I did get a copy. And what it shows, interestingly enough, is that she, in the thesis, rejects Alinsky's methodology as being not effective. And in fact, Alinsky had offered her a job after he met her and she interviewed him in Chicago, and she turned him down because she didn't think he could be that effective. And she wrote in the thesis, interestingly enough, though, that the American Revolution was a radical notion. And though she's often been accused of being a radical, she has always moved away from it and kept her foot very firmly in the establishment aspect of the political world. And yet, she's also, in these attempts at self-description, tried to hide her brush with radicalism, as in locking up that thesis. And in her first summer after law school, she went to work during her first semester in law school, she was a monitor in New Haven at the Black Panther trial for the ACLU, looking for prejudicial government conduct that might have unfairly affected the Panthers. But she then went to work the following summer in Oakland, California, for probably the preeminent radical left law firm in America, Truhaf, Walker, and Burstein in Oakland. And I talked to Bob Truhaf, who's someone I knew from my own childhood, who was the head of the firm and had been a member of the Communist Party along with another member of the firm, though they didn't become open members or didn't acknowledge they had been members till after Hillary was there. But he said, look, Hillary came to us because she wanted to know about movement law. She shared a lot of the values. And when Hillary wrote in Living History about that summer, she writes about living in Berkeley with Bill and working at a law firm, and that's it, as if it was a law firm that handled postal rate increases. And I say at the end of the book, Hillary Clinton has had a difficult relationship with the truth. And I think the book puts these tensions in context. But I also think it's something that very much may play in the campaign, because obviously it is figured in her history. And one of the things you begin to see is the context in which some of these difficulties take place, particularly when she's not forthcoming, as her lawyer says to me, with the special prosecutor. Well, why not? Because she thought she was going to be indicted if she gave him too much information. But you start to see context, which is all important to the best obtainable version of the truth. One of the wonderful things that, unlike talk shows, that writing a book and reading a book enables you to do is to see ambiguity and to see the difficulties of real life as lived. And I think that's what we get in this story of this really compelling life, which is far more interesting than the canned, tinned, airbrushed, cleaned-up version that Hillary gives us. And one of the things that becomes apparent is that at Wellesley, she was very much a young woman who became in charge of her own life. And at Wellesley, after this first semester depression, in which she wanted to go home and quit Wellesley. She was with all these debutantes. She was from the Midwest. These girls that she went to school with had been to Europe in the summers, spoke foreign languages fluently, and she was a fish out of water. And her father said, come home. And her mother said, no, don't be a quitter. And she stayed. And this youth minister, she wrote him in a series of letters about this depression, and he reminded her of a sermon by Paul Tillich, and he had brought with him that high school year in Park Ridge the theology of Tillich, Bierhoffer, Reinhold Niebuhr, 20th century theologians who believed that among other things, that the Christian had a duty to be political, and that one's politics needed to be informed by spiritual notions and by the Gospels. And you'll be interested to hear that in fact, when Bill Clinton lost the governorship after one term, Hillary considered becoming president of a Methodist college in Arkansas. She turned the job down but started teaching Sunday school and giving sermons around the state, including one I've never been able to find the text, and I sure would love to find it, one titled Women Armed with the Christian Sword by Hillary Rodham Clinton. But at Wellesley, in this depression, her youth minister reminded her of a sermon by Tillich, in which he said, grace happens, or it doesn't happen, but you put one foot in front of the other, and you wait for grace. And that got her through. And interestingly, during the Lewinsky period, she stayed in touch all through her life with Don Jones, his youth minister. During the Lewinsky period, he reminded her of this sermon. And she has said that her faith got her through the Lewinsky period. And interestingly enough, one of the first things she did when she went to the White House is she joined a women's prayer group without a lot of fanfare, whose members included Susan Baker, the wife of Jim Baker, who had been Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, and George Bush the Elder's secretary of state. Her husband, of course, Bill, had just beaten Bush for the presidency, and now she was in a prayer group with Susan Baker and Jack Kemp's wife and a woman named Leachman, who was a lay minister at Ken Starr's church, whose husband was the chaplain of the Washington Redskins. And these women, on Wednesdays, they met. They prayed. They exchanged spiritual axioms with each other. Hillary always carried a little Bible with her with little things tucked in it, sayings and notions of spiritual concerns that she's jotted down. And these women came to the White House all through the 8 years to pray with Hillary, including especially during the Lewinsky period. All very surprising, very different than we're used to looking at Hillary Clinton. And I mentioned the Depression because her father had a brother who was going through a deep depression around the time Hillary was born. And he got a call, her father, from his parents back in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and said, please come home. Your brother is really in a state. He got home just in time to find his brother hanging from a rafter. And he cut him down, saved his life, and he took him back to Chicago to live with Hillary, the infant, Dorothy Rodham, her mother, and himself. And this brother descended, and he had been the great hope of the family, this brother. He had been a physician, but he descended in Chicago into alcoholism and died in a fire that was set by a lit cigarette. And Hillary, after Vince Foster's suicide, and the suicide of Vince Foster is like a delineating line in her life in the Clinton presidency. As Webb Hubble said to me, Vince Foster was not Hillary's lover. He was closer than a lover. There was none of the messiness of a love affair. And of course, among other things, he now had all of the Clinton secrets in his files because he was Hillary and Bill's lawyer in the White House and deputy counsel. And when he committed suicide, it made it possible for the enemies and opponents of the Clintons to rightfully demand to know, you know, some of what was in those files. And it began a fishing expedition that came to decimate the Clinton presidency with the appointment of a special prosecutor and the years of investigation that followed. And what were those investigations about? They weren't about the presidency. They were really about what happened back in Arkansas. Embarrassments. Always about embarrassments, humiliations. And Hillary embarked, after Vince Foster's suicide, on a great discussion, ongoing discussion for years with William Styron, the great novelist, about depression, including in her family. And I talked to Bill Styron at great length about this, who had great admiration for Hillary. And again, it's another subtext. It's another little bit of a key to this surprising life. What was Bill Clinton's other women, what were his other women about in terms of Hillary? Well, Hillary Clinton, many of us of a certain age knew in the late 60s and early 70s that Bill Clinton was maybe the greatest, most dazzling political talent of our generation. What Hillary knew from the beginning of her marriage, if not before, was that Bill's sexual compulsions, as she called them, would render him, if known, if they became widely known and their effect became known, would render Bill Clinton politically untenable, not viable politically. So she began to contain knowledge and to keep that stain from spreading. She began covering up his affairs. And partly through Betsy Wright, who told me story after story of how lawyers were hired, detectives were hired to discredit the women or to investigate them and find out there was no affair. But how this came to consume more and more of Hillary Clinton's life. Fear of embarrassment, fear of humiliation. She had gone to Arkansas, not taken the bar exam, followed Bill, sublimated her own aspirations to his. And yet, he was faltering. And she took it upon herself to keep him from faltering by covering these affairs up. Well, you have to start to ask yourself, what might that do emotionally to someone? And Webb Hubble told me how it went so far that Hillary had the law firm, the Rose firm, where he, Hubble, Vince, and Hillary were partners, represent five women and get their affidavits that they had never had affairs with Bill Clinton, and perhaps they had not, or probably had not, when the Clintons' opponents filed a lawsuit against them in the late 80s against Bill Clinton, saying that there had been a slush fund in the governor's office to entertain women, and it was inferred that five women had been involved with the governor. Well, Hillary had her law partner, herself, and her other law partner hired to represent the women. And they got affidavits from them, and Hillary interrogated one of them. Again, you got to ask yourself, now, what might that do to someone? So what I've tried to do in this book, and then you see in the Senate years, after she had, you know, she makes a decision to run for the Senate, where she's from New York, where she's never lived. The pros say it'll never happen. She can't do it. She'll never pull it off, and of course she does. Why does she run? Well, as her closest friends told me, for redemption. Her own redemption, theirs, that of the Clinton president. Can you imagine that at the time of impeachment, when I started to do this book right after impeachment, that if I had said to you, I'm going to see you in Philadelphia in 2007 on the eve of the presidential debate, and Hillary Clinton's going to be in your town, and she's going to be the front runner for the presidency, you would have said you're smoking something, Bernstein. Inhaling. I mean, who could have imagined? Yet here we are. And it goes to the remarkable perseverance of Hillary Clinton, but it also goes to the fact that in the Senate, she found herself. She became a woman in charge of her own life when no longer pulling Bill Clinton's train. And very much like she did when she was the president of the Wellesley student body and had a kind of self-assurance and ease about her that her friends now see her in a way that they've never seen her since the Arkansas years. Now, I'm compressing and oversimplifying perhaps some things, but this is to give you some idea of the narrative sweep of this tale that you're going to read. So I want you to read it, and for all the reasons we've talked about today. And I want to thank you for coming out on this this rather important day in the primary process, a truly absurd and outrageous process in itself, in which most people in the country have absolutely no role in picking the nominee of either of the parties, unless they happen to live in an early primary state. But here we are, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have, and thank you very much. There are microphones, so raise your hand, and somebody will bring a mic to you. That gentleman right there. Yes.
Thank you for coming to the library. My question is, given your knowledge of Hillary Clinton, what advice would you offer Barack Obama in order to advance his candidacy?
I love being a reporter. And I think the last thing I would ever do in my life would become a political consultant. And I wouldn't know where to begin. My view of politics is rather naive, and that is get up and say what you believe, tell the truth, and let us know who you are. That would be my advice. Yes, ma'am. Yes. You. Yes. With your hand up.
Hi. I just was wondering, I don't know, how does she feel about your book?
How does Hillary feel about my book? Well, I'm not sure. Hillary did not read newspapers in the White House years and many of the gubernatorial years, does not like to read about herself. And I doubt that she's read the book, though I know Bill has read the book, and I think Bill knows it's a good book. The campaign, it's funny, when the book came out, before it came out, and the Washington Post did a front page story about the book and another book that had been published, the Clinton campaign had been trying desperately to get hold of a book before it was published, and they didn't. But the only time I've ever known them not to be deadly effective. But they did not get a book, and yet they said when these front page stories based on it came out, oh, it's all old news. But since then, they haven't said a word. And I know from people in the campaign that who have read the book, including people who'll be in the Clinton cabinet if she wins, they say to me, hey, this is remarkable. Now I got some idea of, it's surprise after surprise. I went to see and almost all of it, it has a verisimilitude because most of the people are quoted on the record. And they would not have been so candid with me, I don't think, if I'd started in 2005. But since I got to them beginning in 1999, like Donna Shalala sat there over breakfast with me and said, well, I told Bill Clinton, don't appoint Hillary to be head of health care because, and this is somebody who Hillary, of course, Shalala had been handpicked by Hillary to be Clinton's Secretary of Health and Human Services. And Shalala says to me, I told Bill, don't give that job to Hillary because if she screws it up, you can't fire her. And she doesn't have the experience. And I went to Lloyd Benson, the Secretary of the Treasury, told me the same thing. It turns out that Bill Clinton's closest economic policy advisors and social policy advisors were against Hillary having that job. So it's one, nothing is as it seems. Yes, sir. You've been trying to get your hand up there.
Thank you for coming to Philadelphia, Mr. Bernstein. Thanks for your work. Thanks for coming to Philadelphia. Thanks for your work you've done over the years, that fight between truth and propaganda. I'm not a citizen.
No, no, I want to know the question. This is for questions only.
Are you going to be at the event at Drexel today?
I don't know if I'm going to go tonight or watch it on television. I haven't decided.
If you would be there, is there one question you would like to ask?
Is there one question that I would like to ask Hillary? Hillary?
Yes.
It's a good question. Yeah. I would say, what do you think is the most important thing that we need to know about you? And just tell us. That would be my question. I have this great belief that the problem with reporters is they're largely terrible listeners, and that they want to, you know, sandbag people with questions to get an answer to manufacture controversy or to take a story the way they think it should go. My experience has been, if you let somebody talk, they're going to really surprise you. They're going to take you all over the place, and you're going to learn a lot. And that's the question I would ask. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My question is, if Hillary wins the presidency, what role do you see her allowing Bill to have?
I think it's more than allowing. I think that look, this campaign is about a restoration. It's not a word that she would use out loud, but that's partly what it is. This, you know, the first Clinton presidency, certainly, especially the early part and the latter part of it, was a co-presidency. And a new Clinton presidency, I cannot imagine it being anything but, except this time she would ultimately be in charge, and ultimately he was in charge in the other one. This is also a love affair. These are two people who fell in love. However dysfunctional you or I might judge from the outside their relationship to be or have been, they are still in love. People who know them, you know, each lights up when the other comes in the room. Each has been the elemental part of the other's process now for 30 some years. He's the most important advisor in the campaign. He's on a mission to get her elected. I think she's picked out and stated a very obvious official or semi-official role for him in an administration if she were president, in which he would go around the world and try to restore the credibility of this country after the most disastrous and catastrophic presidency perhaps in the history of the country. And I think, you know, even his opponents would say he'd be really good at that. But he would, you know, he'd be the right there by her. Yes, sir.
Is she electable given the high negatives
she
has among white men who haven't voted higher than 40% since Lyndon Johnson for the Democratic candidate?
Well, first of all, her husband was electable, and those same white men, he got elected without him, or with him. All the polls show an unusual Democratic advantage going into this, but polls are only snapshots, and anything could happen. But I think her strongest claim as a candidate is, look, we beat the right-wing Republican machine twice, and they did. Granted, once they had an awful lot of help from Ross Perot, and they got 43% of the vote. I think that's the – and she would have to win, say, all the states that Al Gore won plus one, plus Florida, plus Tennessee. You know, there are many ways to put it together. There's no way of knowing, but in terms of white men, you know, I was on the train today with a Republican pollster. And he just said to me, she's going to be the president. I mean, I would never say that with such certainty. But this pollster says she can be the president. I said, oh, that's interesting. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for coming. And second, had you had any contact with Ira Magaziner, who was like at least the co-architect of his failed health care plan, and where is he these days?
Ira Magaziner, I believe, is still up in Rhode Island, and I did not talk to Ira Magaziner. He's one of the few people I did not talk to. He declined, and yes, ma'am.
Congress wanted to impeach the president who was screwing around with one woman, at least one that we knew of. What about a president who's been screwing the whole country?
The question is as follows. Congress wanted to... I'm going to repeat the question because it was so terrific. Congress wanted to impeach a president who was screwing around with one woman, at least one woman that we knew of. What about a president who's screwing around with a whole country? Whether or not we've never, look, the system worked in Watergate. That's what happened. The press did its job. A great senator did its job. A great judge did his job. The House of Representatives did its job. The Republicans on the House Impeachment Committee voted articles of impeachment along with the Democrats. The Supreme Court of the United States, led by a Chief Justice appointed by Richard Nixon, decided unanimously the president wasn't above the law, and the Chief Justice convinced the rest of the court it had to be a unanimous decision to turn over his tapes, that the claim of executive privilege was frivolous. And then Republicans, led by the great conservative Barry Goldwater, marched down to the White House and said, and the Republican leadership said, Mr. President, we're going to vote to convict you if you don't get out of here. The system worked. Incidentally, I spoke at the Nixon Library last week. It was very moving. It's now been taken over by, in a joint agreement with the Nixon Foundation and the National Archives. So the archives run part of it. They took out the exhibit that says that Woodward and I were part of a conspiracy. And anyway, but it was really very moving. And but the system worked. What has happened in the Bush presidency is the system has failed. There has been no congressional oversight. There has been no judicial oversight. The Supreme Court of the United States has chosen to uphold some of these unconstitutional assertions of power by the president. If you look at my website, carlbernstein.com, there are a number of pieces I've written about this for Vanity Fair. Look, this presidency, this president is every bit as mendacious, as dishonest, as assertive of unconstitutional powers, I'd take John Mitchell over, at least he had a sense of humor, over Gonzalez in a minute as Attorney General. This is a record of catastrophe, mendacity, incompetence, that we and the next president and future presidents are in the country is going to spend a long time recovering from. But the system hasn't worked. A part of the system that has worked in the Bush presidency is the press. That since the war began to falter, at least, everything we know about this president and his presidency, we know from reporting in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, the Wall Street Journal, McClatchy, a couple other places. We know nothing from oversight by the Congress, you know, and the system has failed. Simple as that. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Right there.
You said the press has
failed? Yes, absolutely. Wait a minute. You're saying it hasn't, and I'll tell you why. And that is as follows. I think the press in the first months, the first part of the Bush administration was very much like the press in the Nixon administration, until we went to war. But once we went to war and it became apparent that the war was faltering, since then, the press has done a fabulous job.
But you should never have allowed get into the war. I'm talking about the press.
Okay,
the press did not do its job when it should have.
First of all, let's talk about elements of the press. And I think most people here knew an awful lot about the question of whether that there was a debate about weapons of mass destruction. Some of the press did a lousy job, particularly the New York Times, on that question. The McClatchy newspapers did a great job. It's very difficult to generalize about the press. But I'm not going to disagree with you. I said I think that the early days of the Bush presidency were like, for the press, the early days of pre-Watergate Nixon, that the kind of acceptance of what they said was what they were doing, not a great performance. But once it became apparent, I think the press has done a great job since. Listen, I want you all to come upstairs. I'm going to sign your books. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.